Hello, this is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to our first ever Diabetes Boot Camp. And we're really excited to provide this broadcast to help you succeed at the CDE exam. As a CDE myself, I've taken the exam over 5 times. And so I take it every 5 years, and I've passed every time, so you're in good hands. And the reason I take it every 5 years is so I can share with you what I found during the exam. What's the philosophical underpinnings? What kind of questions are they asking? What is their real focus? And over the 20 plus years I've been taking this exam, it's been pretty consistent in that they're really helping us to be the best diabetes educators we can be, and it's a lot about application. So I hope you find this series helpful for your studies, but also really importantly to help you gather more information about diabetes education and how to provide the best care possible to your patients. I'm Beverly Tomasian, and my company is Diabetes Education Services. Here on this slide, I have our website, and I'm sure you've already visited it. So welcome to this program, and I really appreciate you attending. I know your lives are busy. I know you've got a lot on your plate, so thank you for making time for this. There's a lot of information to cover today. I have 90 minutes and I have 90 slides. So I know it's about a slide per minute. And it is a boot camp, so what I'm going to do is just move quickly through this material, being reassured that you can listen to this again, and there's other study resources for you to review, you know, those key points. So we're going to meet for 5 consecutive Tuesdays from 11:30 a.m. Pacific time to 1 p.m. After the program's over, I do stay on. It's offline, though, so I'm not recording it. You can ask questions, and I will answer them. After we do the live session, the recorded version of this course will be offered within 4 hours. So 4 hours after I'm done, it takes me a while to set it up and everything. You can listen to this recorded version on your computer through our Diabetes Education University site. And at that time, after you listen to the webcast, or if you've already listened to it, you can just take the quiz and get your CEs. You print out your CE certificate immediately. And if you have any questions or concern, please email us. And the email is laney@diabetesed.net. And here's the beautiful Laney. You've talked to her, I'm sure. She is so helpful and really dedicated to providing excellent customer service. So if there's anything we can do to improve the quality of this program, we want to be of service to you. That's really, really important to us. So let us know. So getting ready to take the CDE exam, what we've provided as part of this bundle is 5 recorded webcasts, so I'll be going through these boot camp topics, but there are online courses, 7 of them. And you don't have to listen to all the online courses, but if you have an area that you're not particularly strong in, you don't work in that area, like kids or adults, older adults, women who are pregnant, you really want to listen to those webcasts, because I've tool them to help you prepare for the CDE exam. Another piece of information and advice, and I am going to give some advice today, is take as many practice tests as possible. As adult learners, we haven't taken tests that much lately. It causes anxiety, just the thought of a test. So take as many practice tests as possible. Study what you don't know. We tend to want to study what we do know. So go to your unfamiliar, keep it positive, but most important, remember the journey. Why are you working for your CDE? Well, maybe you get a little bit of a pay raise, but really for most CDEs, it's not about becoming wealthier. It's about becoming the best diabetes educator you can be by increasing your breadth of knowledge, by increasing the tools in your tool belt to help our patients with diabetes have the best quality of life possible. So remember the journey. Really, really important, because at the end of the day, we just want to really, you know, provide the best we can to our patients. So I'm going to do a few polls right now. So polls are one way that I can learn a little bit about you and I get some feedback, and also to kind of raise your awareness about what's on the exam and kind of help us focus. So I'm just kind of reaching out now and saying, what best describes your profession? And so we can kind of share with each other what our specialty areas are. Yeah, so just take a second to vote. I won't take too much time on this question. So I really appreciate your participation, and I get to share these polls with you so you can see learn a little bit more about your colleagues. Okay, I'm going to close it and share. So you can see about a quarter of us are dietitians, half are nurses. We have a few pharmacists and providers. Welcome, everybody. And 33% of us are educators. So a lot of us have dual roles. We are a healthcare professional, but we also see ourselves as an educator, which we all do education and a lot of it. I want to ask another question. This is about the CDE exam. What are some study strategies that will help you succeed at the CDE exam? And you can choose more than one. So just kind of choose what you think are the right answers. Thank you, everybody, for voting. So this first part of this presentation is just a brief review of how to succeed at the CDE exam, but I would encourage you to listen to our webcast. I spend, you know, an hour talking about the exam, and you can fast forward on that webcast till I start talking about the exam, because our first part talks about qualifications. Okay, 95% of you have voted. So let me share this with all of you. So the first answer is focus study time on topics you're familiar with. Generally, we would say we want to focus our time on topics you are not familiar with. So a lot of us want to study what we know. Don't study what you know, study what you don't know. So B, yes, take as many practice tests as possible. That is absolutely correct. And then C, I threw this out there, read as many books on diabetes as you can. I wouldn't suggest this unless it's really directed to a particular topic, because you might just get overwhelmed with information. And what I want you to do is really focus in on those critical key content areas you need to learn more about to succeed. So while reading books on diabetes is great, for right now, I would focus on that key content area, which is in the outline that I have on our website. So that's just kind of something to think about. Develop a study plan and block off time. Absolutely. You need to develop time for yourself and set aside time for yourself to study. And if you can, the last one is also correct. Teach the content to someone else that maybe your colleagues at work or somebody else is taking the exam. When you teach the content, you learn the content. And if anybody of you have ever put a presentation together, which I'm sure you have, you will know that. I'm going to ask one other question. What are some of the underlying themes of the CDE exam? What are some of the underlying themes? And this is really important information, because there's something that I call the philosophical underpinning of the exam. That is, what are they trying to get at in this exam? What are they trying to help diabetes educators, or to evaluate if diabetes educators are successfully doing as part of their job as a diabetes educator? All right, I'm going to just give you a few more seconds to vote. And you know what? There's no wrong answer here. All we're really doing is just sharing ideas. And when you take quizzes, studies show that it really helps you focus your attention to the details that are really most beneficial to you. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it. So this is kind of interesting. A was what I would call a trick question, so I'm already going to apologize for A. And A says, CDEs motivate people to change behavior. Actually, we can't really motivate people to change behavior. Where does that behavior change motivation come from? Only from within the person. So we can provide patients with information, we can provide them with support, we can provide them and work and set up self-care goals, but we can't motivate them to change. So I don't think they're going to ask a question like that, but I think it's a very important philosophical underpinning, is that we can't make people do anything. It has to come from them. But look at this. B, you got right. 89% of you chose this. CDEs do empower patients to improve diabetes self-management skills. Absolutely. So we're going to empower patients to make changes in their own behavior. So a CDE is really important. It's diabetes self-management. We know that, you know, 90% of diabetes management is done by the person living with it every day. You all got this right. C, consider individual needs, goals, and life experiences. Absolutely. That's a huge underpinning of the exam. Always consider the individual. And D, help all people with diabetes achieve A1C less than 7. Only a bunch of you chose that, and you're right. This is not one of the goals of becoming a CDE. Of this exam. That's not the underpinning of this exam. Mostly what it would say is help people live the best life possible given their situation. Because not all people can achieve an A1C of less than 7. Some of our older patients, we may have to just target the A1C of less than 8. And I want to point out something when you're test taking. Whenever the answer has a word all in it, it's usually wrong. So we could say help most people with diabetes achieve an A1C less than 7. That would be a better answer, but whenever you see all, always be suspicious. And then E is also correct. CDEs provide ongoing care and collaboration. Absolutely, and this is important. We just don't provide one-stop shopping where they come, they get education, and we don't interact with them anymore. No, we are obligated to reach out to them through follow-up, through support groups, through phone calling. This is a very important part of what we do, ongoing care. So I hope that helped. That's a little bit getting to the underpinning of the exam and kind of what they're really looking for in the answers. So a lot of times they're going to give you case studies and they're going to ask you for answers, and you want to keep these qualities of the exam in mind. Okay, I hope that helped. Let's keep going. Overview of the exam, there's 200 questions, and it's based on a job analysis that was completed in 2013. So what they did is they said, hey, tell us what you do as a diabetes educator every day. And I took this analysis, you know, with everybody else in 2013, and I provided input on what I do every day, and they base the test questions on that. What does a diabetes educator do on a usual basis? If you're a spring test taker, which you all are not, you're fall test takers, but spring test takers did not get their results for 8 weeks. I don't know about the fall test takers. It's a new exam. They just started it this year. So you may not get your results right away either. I'm going to check into that. Here's a definition of diabetes self-management education. Circle this, know this. It involves persons with pre-diabetes or diabetes caregivers and educators, and it's defined as an ongoing process of facilitating knowledge, skill, and ability for self-care. Ongoing. So we're facilitating that patient to gain the knowledge. We can't give it to them. They have to grab it, but we're going to help them achieve empowerment and self-care. It incorporates the needs, goals, and life experiences as guided by evidence-based standards. This is really big. We don't just do this stuff based on that it feels good. There's actually evidence to support that focusing on behavior change, empowering patients, helping them with informed decision-making, self-care behaviors, problem-solving, and active collaboration actually results in improved A1Cs and improved outcomes and improved quality of life. So this is all based on evidence, which is very important. And the other thing about the exam details is the questions are linked directly to a task or test. So they will ask you some basic straightforward questions like, you know, what is the diagnostic criteria for diabetes? But many times they're going to apply it to a situation. So they're going to give you a lot of case studies and vignettes. They want to evaluate if you have the ability to apply this information to a job situation, which totally makes sense. The other thing I want to let you know, of the 200 questions, 25 are not counted into your score. They're just trial questions. They're trying to see if they're well written or not. So you do have the opportunity at the end of the exam to write your feelings, thoughts, comments on the exam questions. So if there's something that was really weird to you, you can write it down even though it's a computerized test. And then what to study. So on the link I gave you where it has the slides and the handouts for this webcast, I've also listed some articles. Download those, read them. They're very, very important, and they're going to help you succeed at this exam. But even more important than that, they're going to help you be a great educator, because they talk about the standards of care, evidence-based information that you could share with your colleagues and your patients. But here's that, what I was talking about, the CDE examination content outline. Download that. It's only 2 pages, and it's a real nice self-check for you. You can read through the different objectives to see, am I familiar with all these different content areas? I put together this little cheat sheet. It's really actually pretty nice. Screening and Diagnosis of Diabetes 2014. So it talks about risk factors and for diabetes, what the diagnostic criteria is for diabetes, prediabetes, and gestational. A nice little a sheet to memorize. Study tools. So one of my questions says, do you get all the books, you know, possible and read all of them for diabetes? And well, that is appealing to me. For this exam, I just want to say there's two major books I would consider. And this is the Art and Science of Diabetes Self-Management Education Desk Reference, just released by the AADE. It's over 800 pages. It is so big. Even to get through this book is really hard. So what I would suggest to you first is take tests. Take practice tests. This review guide, if you've already have it, has 200 questions in the book, plus you get 200 questions computer-based if you've bought the book this year. So you get a total of 400 questions. On our webcast preparing for CDE, that's part of this bundle that you purchased, there's 100 questions computerized there. Take as many practice tests as you can. Why do you take these? A, get comfortable with test taking. B, to find out what you're least comfortable with. So when you get answers wrong, don't fret. Study that topic. Study that subject. It just means you need a little more review there. So that's what I really, really want to encourage you all to do. And that's your homework for this week. If you haven't done it already, take a test. Find out where you are really excelling and where you need to study more. And I'm a nurse, so as a nurse, I need to study more on nutrition. Maybe if you're a dietitian, you need to study more on meds. Maybe if you're a pharmacist, you need to study more on nutrition. I don't know. All of us have our different skills that we bring to the table. If you're not, you know, so anyways, so we tend to study our comfort, study your discomfort, because that's where the learning takes place. I always tell my kids, if it hurts when you're learning something new, it's good, because it means you're expanding your brain. All right. We're going to talk now about diabetes more than hyperglycemia. We're going to change gears and talk about pathophysiology, epidemiology, diagnosis, and risk factors for the different types of diabetes. And we're going to wrap up talking about insulin resistance and vascular disease. So the test is going to have questions on this, but it's going to ask the questions in maybe some couched ways. And I'm going to give you some examples of that, so that they may ask you directly for diagnostic criteria, or they may give you a patient situation. But you definitely need to know the difference between type 1, type 2 diabetes, prediabetes, gestational diabetes. You need to have a clear understanding of each of those conditions and how they might present. So diabetes epidemiology is also part of the exam, and that is, what is our current status of diabetes globally and also in the United States? And that is, we're seeing a tremendous epidemic, not only in America, but throughout many countries, especially developing countries. India, China are seeing a surge in diabetes as their population moves more from the farm to the city. And as we change the way we eat, we're increasing our weight and increasing the risk of diabetes globally. So now chronic diseases have outpaced infectious diseases. And the CDC and the United Nations and the World Health Organization is really trying to figure out how we're going to deal with these chronic diseases in the midst of all this change in our environment. But in America, we know that 35% of Americans will have diabetes by the year 2050. And currently only 9% of Americans have diabetes. So from going 9% in 40 years up to 35% is a tremendous increase. These are numbers that are really great to be familiar with. 27% of adults who have diabetes don't know they have it. So 1 in 4 have it and don't know it. And look at this, 37% of U.S. adults have prediabetes. So we definitely know that about 79 million adults in America are running around with hyperglycemia, and most of them are non-detected. We have a crisis happening. We also know that diabetes isn't fair, and they will definitely ask questions about different ethnicities and risk associated with diabetes. But here's the age-adjusted diabetes prevalence 2014 for age 20 years and older in the United States. And this is all data from the CDC. And you can see non-Hispanic whites have the lowest rate of type 2 diabetes, looking at American Indians and Alaska Natives with the highest rates. And the Pima Indians, as you can see here, have a very high rate of diabetes, maybe up to 50% in some populations. So diabetes isn't fair on who gets it, which groups get it. Some populations are more likely to get type 2 diabetes than others. And so you can look at this slide and be familiar with those who are at higher risk. And the other thing about body weight, you know, we talk about body weight where the BMI of 25 or greater puts you at risk for diabetes. And that is true, but according to the American Diabetes Association standards of care, if you really drill down and look at different populations and ethnicities, you can see that different cutoff BMIs are true based on your ethnicity. Like South Asians, they can't weigh as much as different cultures and still have the same rate risk of diabetes. So it's because these different cultures tend to gather the extra weight abdominally or viscerally. And so at lower BMIs, they're more likely to express type 2 diabetes. So this is just great to know for our practice as we work with different people. And so we can really identify higher risk groups within our communities too. One third of all Medicare dollars go to treat diabetes. I still can't believe that. And when we think about Medicare, we're always talking about, you know, Medicare is going broke, we don't have enough money. And we know that a lot of that money goes to treat, not to prevent diabetes, but to treat complications of diabetes. So you can see here the total cost of diabetes is $245 billion annually. And most of that money is going to hospital inpatient care. So my thought is, what if we, and not just my thought, but many experts, let's move some of that money to prevention to see if we can't stop this onslaught of diabetes, because we know prevention works. But we won't get to that today. We'll get to that on our next program. So you'll have to hold on for a week to talk about prevention of diabetes. What I like to do, though, right now is launch another poll. And we're going to talk about pathophysiology. So a patient's admitted to the hospital or with an MI, what are some hormones that are working to increase the blood sugars to cause hyperglycemia? Which of the following hormones are going to increase blood glucose levels? And you can choose more than one. Increase. Thank you, everyone, for voting. I really appreciate it. Okay, take one more second to vote. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this. Thank you so much, everyone. So let's just go ahead, and I'm not going to answer this right now, but let's go ahead and look at the following slides to give you the answer. So as part of this exam, you want to be familiar with which hormones raise blood sugars and which hormones lower blood sugars and how those play a role in glucose regulation. And I'll give you the answers in a minute. So here's the pancreas, and I am an absolute pancreas lover. Love my pancreas because it's on the job 24 hours a day. So I just want to talk about my pancreas for a minute, and then, I'm going to just go to the next slide. So the reason I love my pancreas is because it's the ultimate glucose thermostat. When my blood sugars are elevated, my pancreas gets a message through the hyperglycemic levels in my bloodstream. The pancreas gets a message, you better release some insulin. So if I eat breakfast, then my blood sugars start going up as a result of that carbohydrate ingestion, which they will go up. As the levels of sugar rise in my blood, my pancreas gets a message, you better get to work and release some insulin. So insulin is released into my bloodstream. And what that insulin does, as you know, is take the sugar from my meal and actually move it into my cells. And in particular, you'll see that Insulin helps store glucose as glycogen in two major locations, muscle and liver. This is important. So most of that glucose initially is stored in the muscle and the liver as glycogen. And you need to know these terms for the exam too. What is glycogen? Stored glucose. That's really important. So insulin is secreted in response to elevated levels of blood sugar. It's a great feedback loop. Sugar's up, insulin released. It also, this is very important, halts the breakdown of glycogen in the liver. You see, the liver is quite naughty in that it wants to release its glycogen stores, especially if you haven't eaten for a long time. And I just had a patient come in and she goes, you know, I eat dinner or I eat a snack. The last snack I have is 10 o'clock at night, but I don't eat lunch again until 11 in the morning. And when I check my blood sugar, it's really high. She goes, how could that be? I haven't eaten for almost 12 hours. Well, I'm going to tell you the answer. It's your liver's fault because your liver is releasing sugar because there's no sugar coming in through food. And so your liver's like, hey guys, there's no glucose coming down. I better release some fuel to get the blood sugars up. That system works great if you don't have diabetes, but if you have diabetes, that system doesn't work great. And the reason is you don't make enough insulin to keep the liver in check. We'll talk about that more, but so insulin is very important to halt the breakdown of glycogen in the liver. Let me just bring up one more example of why it's so important. A lot of times our patients wake up with morning hyperglycemia. We give them basal insulin at night. You see, we're trying to imitate what the pancreas should be doing by giving insulin basal at night. Or we'll use metformin at night to help get those morning blood sugars down. And so insulin is a very important life-saving hormone that helps us store glucose as glycogen in muscle and liver. It's secreted in response to blood sugar going up. It tells the liver, don't release glycogen. But look at this, so important. Insulin is also is critical for storing protein and fat. So it's going to take amino acids and store it as protein, and it's going to take all that, those free fatty acids and triglycerides, and store them in the fat cells. So I'm going to bring up something important. With diabetes, you don't make enough insulin, so you can't store your fat effectively, so it stays in your blood. The free fatty acids and triglycerides stay in the blood, and a lot of our patients have hypertriglyceridemia and excessive free fatty acids. Because their fat cells aren't getting the insulin to store the fat, plus the fat cells are insulin resistant. Okay, insulin is important to help us store glucose, protein, and fat. And insulin is a very powerful hypoglycemic. It will bring blood sugars down. But the beta cells aren't alone out there. They also have, insulin's not alone. The beta cells also make amylin. Now, amylin is a hormone that's secreted in a one-to-one ratio with insulin. It makes you feel full, and it lowers postprandial glucagon response, slows gastric emptying. If you have type 1 diabetes, if your patient does, they make none of this, and type 2s make less than normal amounts. So insulin and amylin working together to lower blood sugars. But there are hormones that raise blood sugars, and here's one of the biggest one, and it's called glucagon. Glucagon is made by the alpha cells. It's a very important hormone because if your blood sugars are too low, your pancreas also detects that. So these are alpha cells sitting on your pancreas that say, hey, blood sugar's too low, I better release some glucagon. So glucagon is the hormone that actually tells the liver to liberate sugar. It's stimulated in response to low glucose levels. It stimulates the liver to convert glycogen into glucose. Glycogenolysis, you might hear that word on the exam, glycogenolysis. It inhibits the liver from taking up glucose, and it causes hyperglycemia. Glucagon is released when our blood sugars are too low, when we haven't eaten for a while, or when we're in a stress state. So you remember that guy with the MI? He was in a stress state. He was releasing glucagon, and that was making his blood sugars go up and making him a lot more insulin resistant. I'll just mention one more thing about glucagon while I'm here. People with type 2 diabetes make too much glucagon. It's one of the defects. They start pumping out extra glucagon even after meals. So with diabetes, I'm going to go back one more second. The pancreas is broken. You're not making enough insulin, so you can't get your blood sugars down. You're not making enough amylin. You don't feel sated. And then you're making too much of this thing called glucagon. So you can see that that is what's leading to hyperglycemia, but that's not it. There's other factors that are influencing the blood sugars, and we've talked about one of these, glucagon. So let's talk about these different hormones' effect on blood sugar. And I'm going to repeat key concepts as we go through this. So I'm just going to kind of build on what I'm talking about right now. And the first thing is that glucagon raises blood sugars. We know that. But what about stress hormones? So the corticosteroids in the adrenal cortex, they release it releases hormones when I'm under stress, when I've had an MI, heart attack, stroke, when I have cellulitis. All these stress hormones are activated to try and help my body overcome the infection. But when I have diabetes, it doesn't work that good because it raises my blood sugar. I don't have enough insulin to keep things in balance. Epinephrine, so that's a flight or fight response, right? Epinephrine, or also known as adrenaline. I release that when I'm under stress, when I have an infection, when I'm scared, to raise my blood sugars. So you can see these three hormones are very important at raising blood sugars. They are going to raise blood sugars. What hormones help us lower blood sugars? Well, we have insulin. We have amylin. These are a little bit unaligned. I apologize about that. And look what else we have, the gut hormones. So here, this is important. So that gets back to that little pop quiz I gave all of you. What hormones raise blood sugar? What hormones lower blood sugar? So we have three, and there's others that raise it, but those are the most important ones, and three that lower it. Now, these gut hormones are extremely important, and we've only been talking about them now for maybe 10, 15 years. These hormones are released when we eat food to help lower our blood sugars and stimulate the pancreas to make insulin. We'll be talking more about these in the medication section as we talk about the GLP-1 agonist medications. So if you haven't downloaded our pocket card yet, I would really encourage you to do so, because on the pocket cards you can look at all the medications that are available for diabetes and start memorizing those pocket cards. So on the exam, I'm just going to get this out right now. They do give you generic and trade name, but you need to know class two. What class, this class of medication does what, and what are its considerations? So you need to know the name, what it does, but also you need to know what the different classes of medications do also. And like I said, I'll be covering that a lot more. But as we've learned about what are the defects with diabetes, we've developed medications to address each of these defects. So when the pancreas can no longer keep up with the workload, when the pancreas can no longer make enough insulin, make enough amylin, where there's not enough gut hormone being made, because it is true that people with diabetes, they're supposed to make gut hormone, but when you get diabetes, you make a lot less. People with diabetes make about 50% less gut hormone. And that's type 2, but they're thinking maybe for type 1 also. So when you don't have enough insulin, you don't have enough amylin, you don't have enough gut hormone, and these other counter-regulatory hormones are playing a bigger role in your blood sugars, you start seeing the signs of hyperglycemia. And here they are. I don't need to spend a lot of time on these, but definitely for the exam, you want to know all the signs of hyperglycemia. And a lot of my patients will come in and they'll have this infection out of the blue. They're like, why do I have this infection? And I know it's because of hyperglycemia. When you have hyperglycemia, your white blood cells don't work as well, and you feed the bacteria with all that glucose in the blood. And a lot of people think, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. It's just I'm getting older. That's why I'm so tired and going to the bathroom a lot. But just because you're getting older doesn't mean you should be tired. You should feel great even as you get older. And so a lot of times our patients have diabetes but don't want to acknowledge it. So that's part of our job, to get out and find those people who have diabetes and are in denial. I'm sure you know some patients like that, some people like that. Okay. I'm going to do one more poll. I'm going to do a lot. I have a few more, but I can only do eight per class. I wish I could do more. Which of the following glucose levels, oh, I'm sorry, which of the following levels are considered pre-diabetes range? You can choose more than one. which of the following levels are considered pre-diabetes range? On the exam, there's only one correct answer, but for purposes of learning, I provided a few correct answers. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. So if you don't know some of these answers, you're not sure, you know what? That's okay, because that just gives you information about what to focus on in your studies, right? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this. So which of the following levels indicate pre-diabetes? And I'm going to just share what you chose for a minute, and then we're going to look at the answers together. All right, I'm going to hide that. Let's go to the next slide. Here's a natural history of diabetes. So this is a great slide to memorize because it answers the question that I just asked you. And also, as part of the resources I gave you in that link, I have a list of the diagnostic criteria for diabetes. I will be extremely familiar with that with the exam too. Because as part of the exam, they just don't test you on diabetes. They're going to test you on pre-diabetes and diabetes. You need to be knowledgeable about the glucose ranges for both of those. So here's a normal pancreas and a normal pancreatic function. So let's just walk through the history of this person. So this person is born, and one of their parents has type 2 diabetes. And during the first part of this person's life, they're very active. They don't, you know, their weight is great. They're exercising. Now they're in high school, and now they're about to enter college. So we know because one of their parents had diabetes, or maybe their mom had gestational diabetes, this person is at higher risk for getting diabetes in the future. But anyways, just like a lot of us, they went to college. And you know what happens when you go to college is that, well, all of us went to college if you're taking the CDE exam. So what happened when you go to college is lots of times you're out of your house for the first time, you gain some weight, and maybe your exercise life changes a little bit. You're exercising less. And then you graduate with that fancy degree, and maybe you're sitting down more all of a sudden. So, you know, you were a much more active person. Now you have a full-time job. You're sitting down. Average American, by the way, sits down for about 9 hours a day. And you're accumulating some more visceral fat. So over time, you have this genetic. You're gaining weight. You're getting more sedentary. And by the time you're 45, you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, wow, your blood sugars are in the pre-diabetes range. So here's pre-diabetes, fasting blood sugar 100 to 125, a random blood sugar of 140 to 199. I want to tell you that random is not official. That's just kind of an in-between range, in between normal and in between diabetes. But what is official is this, A1C at 5.7 to 6.4. So maybe your provider says, wow, your blood sugar is 112 fasting, or maybe your A1C is, 6.2. Looks like you have some prediabetes. And at that time, only 50% of the pancreas is working. So at this moment in life, that person has the opportunity to make changes and go back to normal. Your pancreas can still recover and rebound and produce enough insulin. But if that guy just goes, you know what, man, I'm just too busy. I've got a job. I'm working full time. I've got a family. If they don't make changes, they're more likely to go over here to diabetes. So know this. Diabetes, a fasting blood sugar, 126, random of 200 or greater, and A1C is 6.5 or greater. And also know the following is that you have to repeat the same test to verify diagnosis. Now, I will say, what if the patient comes in and they're 500 and they have all the signs of diabetes? You don't need to repeat the test. But what if they come in and their fasting is 128? You have to repeat the same test on a different day to confirm diagnosis. great piece of information to know for the exam. If they have a high fasting, repeat the high fasting. If they have a high A1C, we repeat the A1C. We don't do a fasting and an A1C. It gets confusing, or you repeat the same test on a different day. And just so you know, if you're working in a diabetes education program, Medicare still uses fasting glucose as a criteria for reimbursement for education. They don't look at A1C. We have to have a diagnosed elevated fasting blood sugar. I don't think that will be on the exam, but just to let you know, the last part. Okay. We have AJ. She's a 22-year-old female admitted to the ICU. I have a little case study for us, but I'm going to launch a poll so we can find out more. She's admitted to the ICU. What findings would make you suspect she has type 1 diabetes? So you can choose more than one on this also. Okay. Alana told me it won't let you choose more than one answer. Thanks, Alana. On my last one, I apologize about that. So, yeah. I appreciate all your feedback because this is my first time doing the boot camp and setting these up. There's a lot of technological potential disasters that I think I've averted most of the disasters so far. So, I always appreciate feedback. Okay, so we have almost half of you have voted. We're thinking, what is making us suspicious? She's type 1. All right, I'll take a few more seconds. And remember, this is just for you. So you could guess, and there's no wrong answer today. It's just learning. A learning experience. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. Thank you, everyone. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to share this with you. So 70% of you said this patient has a history of celiac disease. You're absolutely right, because people with autoimmune diseases, and celiac is an autoimmune disease, and we'll be talking about celiac disease more on the last class because it does come up on the exam. It's an autoimmune disease where patients have a bad response to gluten, the protein, and it causes their villi in their stomach to really become paralyzed. So they have malabsorption syndrome. So we definitely know that autoimmune diseases tend to run in families, and people with autoimmune diseases like celiac are more likely to have type 1 diabetes. So whenever I meet a new patient and they are newly diagnosed with diabetes, I always look at their autoimmune history to see if maybe they're more toward the type 1 continuum than type 2. Okay, the other thing that would make me suspicious is D, sister has thyroid disease. That would make me think more toward type 1 disease because, again, autoimmune diseases run in families. So I did put C in there as kind of a trick question because that's not evidence-based, just so you know. I mean, people tell me all the time when they get newly diagnosed diabetes, oh, my gosh, I knew I had diabetes. I was eating candy all the time. Well, you might just be hungry because your blood sugars are high, but specifically eating candy doesn't mean you're at risk for type 1 diabetes. So I just want to say on the exam, they're going to put, I call them juicy answers like that, and you want to really be careful with juicy answers because they may not be right. They just are alluring, and you want to choose them. So really think about, is this evidence-based? Is this based on fact, or is it just a juicy answer that I want to pick? So I kind of put that in there for that reason. All right. So how are we going to evaluate if she has type 1 or type 2? So we talked a lot about that already. We're going to see her history of autoimmunity, and we're going to look at her clinical presentation. So let's take a look at these slides as we keep going. So when we think about type 1 diabetes, it used to be called, aren't these kids are so cute, it used to be called juvenile onset diabetes, but they ditched that name because it can happen at any time of the lifespan. But the most common age is 14 years or during puberty. Now here's a very depressing picture that always breaks my heart when I look at it, but this is a photo taken in 1920, and this child is manifesting type 1 diabetes. How do we know that? His pancreas isn't working. He isn't making any insulin whatsoever. None. He makes no insulin. So he eats food. It turns into glucose. The glucose wants to get into the cells. It cannot get into the cells because there's no insulin to open up the cells and let the glucose in. So instead, this child has glycosuria. He's peeing all the time. Glycosuria, you know, just urinating out all of his nutrition. So I'm sure his urine is sweet and sticky. And that was the old way they would diagnose diabetes, right, by this sweet urine. So now his body's trying to get rid of all the excess glucose through urination, but now it needs an alternate energy source. It can't use glucose for fuel. There's no insulin. To use glucose for fuel, you'll need insulin. So now he's going to protein stores, so he's going to burn down. Well, first, usually they'll go to fat stores, so he's using his fat for fuel. And when you break down fat for fuel, that leads to ketone bodies. So you've heard of the word diabetic ketoacidosis. That is the burning of fat for fuel because the body can't use glucose for fuel. So whenever you see, you know, ketones in the blood or ketones or the patient's pH is low because of ketosis, that means they're insulin deficient. Diabetic ketoacidosis always reflects absolute insulin deficiency. We've got to give insulin right away. He's burned his fat for fuel, but he's also burned his muscles for fuel. He's using amino acids to make for gluconeogenesis, creation of glucose from amino acids and other sources. So this child is in an acute starvation state. Because he doesn't make insulin, he can't store fuel. The great news about this kid is that he did receive insulin therapy. He did. I can't believe it. And he lived. He lived. This is not him. This is not him. He looks great if it was him, right? But I'll show you a picture of that little boy after he receives insulin therapy when I do the insulin presentation. It's an amazing transformation. But this is Gary Hall. He's an Olympic swimmer, and he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in his early 20s. So, like I said, type 1 can happen at any age. And he was told, Gary, you've got diabetes. You can't, you know, win Olympic medals anymore. But Gary Hall had a lot of determination, and he won gold in Australia, and he won gold in Greece. And he was an old swimmer. He was like 28 years old when he won his second medal. So, anyways, type 1 doesn't stop anybody from doing anything. But the truth is, many of us don't deal with type 1 that much. Maybe we see more type 2 unless you work in an endocrine clinic. You might see a lot more type 1, of course. But for those of us who just work in the community setting, it may be a smaller population that we work with have type 1 diabetes, but the rates of type 1 are on the rise. And you can see each year approximately 80 people per day are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And the rate is on the rise. Why? We've seen a 23% increase in type 1 from 2001 to 2009. And the truth is autoimmune disease rates are increasing throughout the globe. Globally, autoimmune disease rates are increasing. And they're thinking there must be some changes in the environmental exposure and the gut bacteria. So the gut bacteria, you know, there's trillions, millions to trillions of gut bacteria that have been a part of our ecology and our body microbiome since the beginning of time. I mean, we've evolved with bacteria, and we rely on bacteria, and they rely on us. It's a synergistic relationship. But what we've done is we've got super clean, you know, all these sanitizers that are killing off all the good bacteria, and we're eating foods that are coming in packages. So we're having less exposure to those bacteria that help our gut keep healthy and in balance. So that's a hygiene hypothesis. But the other thought is, you know what? Our kids are getting heavier. So what does heaviness have to do with type 1 diabetes? Well, the heavier you are, maybe they're thinking that if you're a heavy kid, it puts more wear and tear on your pancreas, especially for those kids with a genetic predisposition. So you have the genetic predisposition, you're overweight, the pancreas can't keep up with the workload, and the type 1 expresses itself. So these are working theories. We don't really know. There's a whole trial called the TEDDY trial, T-E-D-D-Y, to look at environmental determinants of diabetes in youth. That's what it stands for. trial of environmental determinants of diabetes in youth to see what the heck is causing this increase in diabetes. It's a long-term prospective trial. We won't know the results probably for another decade, but I'll keep you posted. So you can see here, the general population, the chance of getting type 1 is pretty low, 0.3%. But if you have a sibling, mom, or dad with type 1, your rate is a lot higher. I would really encourage you, if you know anyone with type 1 diabetes, and I'll go over this in a minute, is to have them contact the TrialNet. And TrialNet is doing a lot of great work on looking at the natural history of type 1 and perhaps some prevention strategies. And I have a slide coming up on that, but I just want to say that right now. So type 1 represents 10% of all diabetes, and it's a combination of your genes, risk factors in the environment, maybe risk factors in food, risk factors of we're not really sure what other risk factors, but exposure to a virus is definitely a big one. And you can see there's some viral triggers I've listed here. You have the genetics, you're exposed to this virus, then you'll see a lot of times those kids seroconvert to type 1 diabetes. Autoimmunity does tend to run in families, and we see higher rates in non-breastfed infants. So definitely encouraging breastfeeding for at least a year, especially if they have a risk of type 1. The American Academy of Pediatrics says preferably 2 years. So we're trying to think about setting up our environment to support breastfeeding. I just want to say one more thing about breastfeeding. It not only helps prevent type 1 in kids, but also it helps prevent diabetes in the mom too. Now, I'm not sure about type 1 in the mom, but type 2 diabetes in the mom for sure. We'll talk about that more when I get to my breastfeeding slide. But type 1 is 10% of all diabetes. It's an autoimmune destruction of the beta cells. So for some reason, the body doesn't interpret the beta cells as friend anymore, and it launches an autoimmune attack. Most commonly expressed during puberty, ages 10 to 14, and that's because those pubertal hormones cause more insulin resistance. And the interesting thing is that these patients are pretty insulin sensitive, and that is they don't push away insulin, they suck it up, they absorb it. So their insulin needs are usually based on body weight, very straightforward relationship. And they need about 0.5 to 1 units of insulin per kilogram per day. So type 1 is a combination of genes and disease susceptibility, risk factors, autoimmunity tends to run in families, and there's definitely some viral triggers that seem to cause the expression of the type 1. You see, you can have the type 1 gene, and it can be dormant for your whole lifetime. And you can have the type 1 gene, and it might express early on in your life. So they're trying to figure out what causes that gene to express, and can we stop it from expressing? The good news is that kids and people with diabetes are living longer. So with the better treatment strategies we have and therapies and more real-life-based strategies, patients are doing a lot better with it. So if we're not sure if a patient has type 1 or type 2 based on their clinical presentation, we can actually draw autoantibodies. And I've listed them here for you. So let's just say a patient comes in, their blood sugars are high, they've been losing weight, they are drinking like crazy and going to the bathroom like crazy. But when they present, they're overweight. So a lot of kids, when they present with type 1 diabetes, since a lot of kids are overweight, they might present overweight. So we're not sure, are they type 1 or type 2? And I have a lot of my older patients who come to see me, and they're in their 70s, and they're put on oral medications, and the doctor asked me to see them to help with, diabetes self-management education. And I'm like, I don't think you have type 2 diabetes because of their autoimmune history and they're kind of leaner. I'm thinking maybe you're more type 1. So it can happen anywhere in the lifespan. So to verify if they're more autoimmune, we can draw these autoantibodies, GAD, ICA, and IAA, and I spelled them out here for you. And if one or more of these come back positive, this person is more toward the type 1. So why do we want to know that? Well, we want to know that because then we might start insulin therapy earlier to help protect the remaining beta cells. And so these are three different autoantibodies we can draw to verify if it's an autoimmune disease, type 1. And if these all come back negative, we know they're more toward type 2. I've never seen these autoantibodies appear on the exam, but they might, so I do want to let you know about them. So here's other conditions that are associated with type 1, other autoimmune conditions that you can use in your clinical practice to help you determine, is this patient more type 1 or type 2? And then I have this great slide, what does type 1 look like? And here we have Mary Tyler Moore, who's in her 80s, thriving with type 1 diabetes. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Nick Jonas, rock and roll fame, and of course Bret Michaels, another singer. And then we have athletes. So, you know what, type 1 doesn't stop anyone from doing anything. And then here's that screening. If you know somebody with type 1 diabetes, encourage them to enter this free TrialNet program to get information on genetics and also other resources for their family to maybe prevent type 1 in the future. So with AJ, we now know she has type 1 diabetes. What baseline lab work and tests does she need? What referrals? So here's a slide I would just circle and memorize, that these are the tests that people with diabetes need to get upon diagnosis, and some of them need to be repeated. But you can see here, screen for celiac disease, type 1 at diagnosis, because many times celiac disease is not identified and not treated. We're going to look at their thyroid. Remember, thyroid disease and diabetes go together. Kidney function, microalbuminuria, fasting lipids, A1C, and liver function test. Here's all the different referrals, eye exam, family planning, registered dietitian for MNT, self-management program, dental exam, and mental health. So definitely, as I mentioned earlier on, this is a collaboration. We're an interdependent team. We're going to ask others for help, for referrals, and to evaluate our patients. So here's our type 1 summary, autoimmune pancreatic destruction. They absolutely need insulin, often first present in DKA, and we know that that person's at risk for other autoimmune conditions. Well, we're going to change gears now and talk about type 2 diabetes, but before I do, I'm going to, as you know, launch a poll. JR has a BMI of 32 and is admitted to the hospital with a UTI. What type of diabetes is he at risk for? With the information that you have, what would you guess? And this is just one right answer. Oh, you don't see the poll. Thank you. I'm wondering, hey, everybody's kind of quiet out there. Thank you. All right. You guys are doing excellent on this question. I'm going to go ahead and close this because this was like no-brainer for you all. You're like, of course he's got type 2 diabetes. Yes, absolutely. He has a BMI, he's obese, and he has a UTI, so all those point toward type 2 diabetes. So great job, everybody. But here's a diabetes diva, as she calls herself. She's Patti LaBelle, and she goes, I'm not a diabetic, I'm a diva-betic. That's a mix of diabetic and diva. So Patti LaBelle was out on tour, and you know, she's a very famous singer, she's an amazing human, and she passed out. And what had happened to her is that she had undiagnosed diabetes, and she had wasn't taking very good care of herself, had gained some weight, and then she passed out on stage, found out she had type 2 diabetes. But Patti LaBelle didn't sit and take it. Oh no, she made a comeback, and she goes, I'm going to turn this around and really improve my diabetes. Let me go back to Patti. And she's written cookbooks, she's, you know, exercising and lost weight. I mean, she's a real spokesperson on, when you have diabetes, you just don't, you know, just accept it and do nothing. You take action. And a lot of our patients, you'll see them do that. It's a real motivation for them. And I just thought I'd put this BMI chart up for you, because we talk about BMI of 25 or greater, that's when the risk of diabetes goes up. And you can see when the BMI increases, where is a lot of the increased weight? It's visceral. It's visceral and around the hips. So there's more abdominal fat or visceral fat. And the visceral fat is the real issue of increasing insulin resistance. And the American Diabetes Association and their standards of care do say to consider diabetes consider bariatric surgery on diabetes patients with a BMI of 35 or greater. So that would be in the morbidly obese category, especially if they have comorbidities. What they do see with bariatric surgery is that 40 to 95% of patients immediately after surgery have some remission of their diabetes. Now, I want to define what this word remission means to you. It doesn't mean a cure. It means that the blood sugars go back to normal range without medications. So a lot of patients, even before they lose weight, have this remission of their diabetes. Blood sugars normalize. And look what it's due to: increase in the gut hormone. Remember those GLP-1s I talked about earlier today? After that gastric bypass surgery, the GLP-1 levels go, they just like double. And that increase in GLP-1 helps the pancreas work better and lowers blood sugar. But as you know, when patients have gastric bypass surgery, if they gain the weight, their sugars go back up. This surgery is more effective if we give it to the patient early in the course of their diabetes when they have more beta cell mass. But normally we wait, right? So it's controversial. It's expensive. There's complications. More data to come on that. But who is at risk for type 2 diabetes? And I would just know this for the exam. It's on that diagnostic criteria and risk sheet I have in your handouts. But testing should be considered in all adults who are overweight, BMI of 25 or greater, and have any of the additional risk factors. So these are just risk factors you've heard about a lot. I want to talk a little bit about this last condition, acanthosis nigricans. And acanthosis nigricans looks like this. Acanthosis nigricans is a manifestation in the skin of insulin resistance. So you can see the skin is dark, velvety, and this doesn't just occur on the neck. It can occur in the underarm, waistline, groin, knuckles, elbows, toes. Also skin tags and darkened areas around eyes. This is a manifestation of insulin resistance. So if we see a patient like this, we want to check not only their blood sugars, but their blood pressure and cholesterol, because they're at risk for cardiovascular disease. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So we talked about what is type 1 diabetes. It's an autoimmune disease. But what is type 2 diabetes? I love this slide. This is from the American Diabetes Association. Type 2 diabetes is a complex metabolic disorder, which there's not enough insulin, insulin deficiency, plus insulin resistance, the cells push it away, with social, behavioral, and environmental risk factors unmasking the effects of genetic susceptibility. Wow. So you have the gene for diabetes, and depending on your environment, your behavior, your social context, your income, your social support, you are more likely or less likely to express the disease. And when epidemiologists who specialize in diabetes talk about stopping the disease or decreasing the rates, they talk about environmental changes, making it safer for kids to exercise, making it safer to making better access to healthier foods. Changing the environment will help decrease type 2 diabetes. I'm not saying that the individual doesn't have responsibility. Oh, they do. But how do we, from a public health perspective, decrease the rate? We need to make some changes in the way we shape our environments for our community. The other thing I want to talk about is if you have a patient with a new diagnosis of diabetes, have them call 1-800-DIABETES to request a Getting Started kit. It is free. It is awesome. It comes in English and Spanish. They're working on other languages. But diabetes.org is your go-to organization to get information that's accurate, timely, and based on science and evidence. So here's a natural history of type 2 diabetes. There's just several important things I want to point out on this slide. That type 2 diabetes starts 20 years before diagnosis. It starts really, let's put it all the way back in the womb. What if the mom had gestational diabetes? That child, when they're exposed to that intrauterine environment of higher levels of sugar than what's normal, is more likely to have the genetics for insulin resistance and diabetes. So 20 years before diagnosis, you know, they're in college, they're gaining that weight, they're, you know, sitting a lot. Then what's happening is they gain that visceral adiposity, their insulin resistance increases. As insulin resistance increases, insulin secretion also increases. The pancreas is trying to keep up with the workload. So in the course of the disease, if you were to draw the insulin levels right now, they would be very high. The patient would be hyperinsulinemic because the pancreas is working hard to overcome insulin resistance. And look at the pancreas for 20 years controls the blood sugar, keeps that fasting blood sugar less than 126. But after a while, the pancreas is like, I cannot keep up with this workload. And insulin secretion starts to wax and wane. And actually, this is diagnosis of type 2 diabetes when the fasting blood sugars and postprandial meet the criteria for diabetes. So right here, a diagnosis, what are we going to do? You all know this. Get them to see a dietitian. This is so critical. Losing body weight at the moment you're diagnosed helps protect the remaining beta cells. So we want to help our patients lose weight immediately if they have type 2 diabetes. We want them to get active, and we do start most patients on a medication called metformin. Those are the three treatment strategies, but we need to start fast, take action right away. Don't wait. We want to save whatever beta cells are left in that pancreas. But if that patient continues on, you can see after 30 years of diabetes, they make almost no insulin. So about 30 to 40% of our type 2s need insulin. And I tell my patients, you're not failing. It's your pancreas that's failing. So kind of to wrap up with type 2 diabetes, it's much more complex actually, as it turns out, than type 1. Type 1, complete destruction of the pancreas. But type 2, the pancreas is still trying to squirt out some insulin. There's about 20% left at diagnosis. But there's other things that are broken. So we have decreased amylin and insulin secretion from the pancreas. The liver, I've talked about these things already, so now we're just putting together in a package here. The liver has increased glucose production. I talked about this. There's the fat cells. There's more lipolysis, higher levels of free fatty acids. The fat cells become insulin resistant, so the triglycerides are high, free fatty acids are high, and that's a big problem because all that free fatty acid causes a lot of vascular inflammation. Lots of vascular inflammation. There's increased glucagon secretion. Who makes glucagon? The pancreas. Pancreas is broken. It's releasing glucagon, telling the liver to release sugar. The muscles are insulin resistant. Muscles become very insulin resistant with type 2 diabetes. They don't take up sugar. If the muscles don't take up sugar, sugar's high in the blood. So I'm always talking to patients about exercise, movement. You want your muscles to chew up sugar. Lift weights, do anything to keep your muscles going because muscles are very metabolically active. Maintain your muscle mass. It's a big message to give our patients. Patients with diabetes make decreased gut hormones, 50% less. So you don't get a sense of fullness. You don't get satiation. You don't get a neurotransmission to your brain. Hey, stop eating. The other thing that people with diabetes struggle with is increased glucose reabsorption. Normally, your kidneys let go of sugar when your blood sugars are 180 or greater. When you have diabetes, it upregulates. Glucose is not released till your blood sugars are 210 or greater. 210. So you're reabsorbing sugar. Why is your body doing that? It thinks it's starving. It's pulling back sugar because there's not enough sugar in the cells. It's broken. Everything, you know, there's 8 things here that are broken. And this is a wonderful work of Ralph DeFronzo, who won the Banting Award at the ADA Scientific Session, where he presented this information. So as we talk about pharmacology in a future lecture, you'll see that the different agents are trying to address this. But there's 2 things that will help all of these, 2 things within the patient's grasp. You know what they are? Of course, eating healthfully, losing weight. Maybe it's 3 things, but they're kind of tied together. And exercise will help all of these defects. So, of course, lifestyle is always number 1. So to kind of wrap up this section, and you might ask, what is this LADA thing she has up there? Well, LADA is latent autoimmunity diabetes in adults. It's also known as diabetes 1.5. I don't have time to talk about it today. It's not on the exam. But I will pop an article in your resource list on LADA that you can take a look at. So I really had to figure out what is on the exam. This is a boot camp for the exam, and what is nice to know and important to know. So maybe we can have another meeting later on where I go over some more details. But let's just do this together. Obesity, our type 2s are heavier. Insulin dependence, type 1s need insulin absolutely, type 2s about 30%. Type 2s respond to oral agents, not our type 1s. They need insulin. Who gets ketosis, burns fat for fuel? Our type 1s do. Antibodies, type 1s, type 2s don't have any antibodies. And then what's a typical age of onset? Type 1, we talked about puberty, but it can happen at any time. Type 2, average age currently is about 45, but that number is going down. Who's insulin resistant? Our type 2s are. They make less and they push it away. Our type 1s aren't insulin resistant. Actually, they just suck insulin up. So we just have to replace what they don't make. But type 2 diabetes isn't just a condition of hyperglycemia. It also affects other parts of the body, and it's associated with fatty liver disease, sleep apnea. People with type 2 diabetes have increased risk of cancers of the pancreas, liver, and breast. Alzheimer's, often referred to as type 3 diabetes, is another big issue. I've never seen that on the exam, but I just want to tell you as a very important note that when you have diabetes, you make less insulin, as you all know. As it turns out, insulin is a neurotransmitter in the brain. So if you're not making enough insulin, your brain maybe not be having very good communication left and right side, and the neurotransmission may be delayed, and they have more likelihood of dementia too. So I really talk a lot about exercise and from this viewpoint. Exercise really does help integrate right-left brain connectivity, and learning new things is great for Alzheimer's prevention, crossword puzzles, anything to keep your brain active, very, very important. Let's move on to other types of diabetes. We have gestational diabetes and other specific types. And I do want to say, as part of your online courses, I have a course on women in diabetes, kids in diabetes, older adults in diabetes. We can't cover it all during these webcasts. So if you don't work with women in diabetes or kids, I would really encourage you to listen to those because I can't give you as much detail right now as you'll need for the exam. They will have questions on special populations. And so for this segment, I am going to talk about GDM very briefly, just to say that it's a big problem, because as the rates of gestational diabetes go up in a community, it's a predictor of the future rates of diabetes, because women with diabetes, with gestational diabetes, immediately after pregnancy, 5 to 10% of them are diagnosed with type 2. And within 5 years, they have a 50% chance of developing diabetes, type 2. So women who experience gestational diabetes, they're more likely to get diabetes, and their kids are more likely to get diabetes. So we're really trying to figure out ways to help prevent GDM. And we know that helping women keep at a healthy weight before pregnancy and during pregnancy is very, very helpful to help prevent GDM, especially for those women at risk. It's so true that intrauterine environment is important, not just during the life, that not during those 9 months that the child is in gestation, but during their lifetime. There's some imprinting that's done in that intrauterine environment that does affect their long-term health outcomes. So really, this is a wonderful time to engage women in keeping as healthy as possible, not only during pregnancy, but after pregnancy. So what we're going to do now, the new guidelines say, and this is important for everybody to know, when a woman becomes pregnant, we should screen for undiagnosed type 2 at the first prenatal visit. So when she's pregnant, we're going to check her blood sugars. We're going to check all women's blood sugars when they're pregnant, because we don't want to expose the fetus to hyperglycemia during those first 3 months when organs are developing. And if a woman has high blood sugar that reaches the diagnostic threshold for diabetes during that first check, she's called diabetes in pregnancy, not gestational. So when I first get pregnant, let's say I go in at 10 weeks and I get checked and I find I'm pregnant, and then I find out my blood sugar is elevated, it's 142 fasting, I have diabetes type 2, and I'm classified as diabetes in pregnancy. But if at that moment when I get pregnant, I get my blood sugar checked, it's normal, I'll wait till 24 to 28 weeks to get my blood sugar test with the oral glucose tolerance. Now, there's been a lot of controversy and hubbub about this following two slides I'm going to show you. For a while, we were just going with this one-step procedure where we gave a woman a 75-gram oral glucose tolerance test after an overnight fast. And if she exceeded one or more of these values, she would have GDM. So that still is the case. But with the new guidelines, they also said there is another option, that you can do the two-step glucose tolerance test. So do you need to know this for the exam? I would be familiar that there's two options, and when we screen for gestational diabetes, that would be good to know. I don't know if you need to memorize these numbers. It's kind of up to you, but I don't think they would ask this year anyways, because it just changed. Usually, they won't ask things on the test that just changed last year, because it takes them a while to put the test questions together. But I would be familiar with when we screen for diabetes in women, when they're first pregnant, we check their blood sugars. If it's normal, we screen again 24 to 28 weeks. And if they reach that criteria at 24 to 28 weeks, they're classified as gestational. And then there's different goals, whether you have diabetes in pregnancy or gestational diabetes. And I would go to that webcast that I have online for you to find out what those targets are, because they may ask targets for women during pregnancy for their blood sugars. Okay, so here's after a woman has delivered and she had gestational diabetes, we know she has a high risk of getting diabetes in 5 years. We're going to screen her at 6 to 12 weeks to see if she does have hyperglycemia, and then we're going to repeat that screening at every three years. We're going to definitely encourage breastfeeding, weight control, exercise, and make sure she has great preconception counseling so before she moves to pregnancy again, she has excellent blood sugar control. And the American Diabetes Association guidelines do say that if a woman had a history of GDM and now presents with pre-diabetes, that's that fasting blood sugar of 100 to 125, we should start her on metformin therapy. So I just want to let you know that. That's really important, especially if you work with that population. So as I've mentioned, I just went over that extremely quick because the boot camp, we're just marching through this information. I do have the online courses where I go over this in much more detail and a much slower pace. Other specific types of diabetes. So we have type 1, type 2, gestational. And there's other reasons that people get hyperglycemia, and one of the main ones is due to medications such as steroids. Many of our patients with cancers, with other conditions like COPD, might have to go on steroids to treat that. And what the steroids can do is cause insulin resistance, because remember, just like corticosteroids from our adrenal cortex, steroids raise insulin resistance and can affect blood sugars. So I really do consider steroids and pregnancy a pancreatic stress test. How well does the pancreas work under fire? And if patients on steroids or during pregnancy become hyperglycemic, I know their pancreas isn't working that good, and they're at risk for future diabetes. So the main thing with those other types of hyperglycemia, not due to traditional diabetes, is regardless of the cause, the hyperglycemia needs to be treated. Insulin will always work, but if we can, we might actually try some oral medications depending on the patient population. Okay, let's do one more poll. We have 15 more minutes, and I'm going to launch this. Which of the following are modifiable cardiovascular risk factors? And you should be able to choose more than one. Oh. So while you guys are answering that, one of our participants said, is metformin approved during pregnancy? No. So on this exam, and I talk about this in the webcast, no oral medications are officially FDA approved during pregnancy. They're all off-label. Only insulin is approved during pregnancy. Okay. So let's get back to this. Let me see. Where am I? Okay, which of the following are modifiable risk factors for cardiovascular disease? I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. Okay, so let me just say that some of you chose family history. So let me explain what is a modifiable risk factor. It means something you can change. And you can't, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your family, You can't change family history. It's like you're born into that situation. You're born into those genetics. You can't ever change that. So that's considered non-modifiable risk factor. The other thing we can't modify is our age. As much as we would like to, we can't roll back the time. And so this was just a question because they're going to ask about modifiable versus non-modifiable. You want to be familiar with. We can modify smoking. You can quit. We can modify hypertension. How? Through medications, diet, exercise, losing weight. And we can modify body weight. I would say that one is most questionable to me because it's so hard for patients to lose weight. But the three modifiable risk factors, smoking, hypertension, and getting the weight down. And so as we go through this next part of the presentation, we really do want to focus on strategies that we can share with patients to help them make changes in their care to improve outcomes. And I want to talk a little bit more about insulin resistance. So I said here, insulin resistance is a seed. What is she talking about? Well, suppose I have the genetic risk for diabetes, or my parents had, insulin resistance, or my mom had GDM, or my dad had type 2. I have a genetic risk for insulin resistance. Let me explain what that means. It means over time, as I get older and I gain weight, and I gain weight especially in the visceral fat area. Here it is. So just let me talk about visceral fat for a minute. It's not subcutaneous fat, which sits on top. It's fat that sits on the organs, sits on the liver, sits on the pancreas, sits on the intestines. It's integrated in there. It's yellow, sticky, nasty fat. Visceral fat is an endocrine organ. It's an endocrine organ that releases cytokines, tumor necrosis factor. It causes inflammation of the blood vessels. Visceral fat is a big problem. And visceral fat is really kind of the seed to insulin resistance because it starts this whole cascade of problems. You have the genetics. You're not exercising. You have visceral adiposity. You had gestational diabetes. Maybe you had polycystic ovary or acanthosis nigricans. Cancer is associated with insulin resistance. So really, I'm going to focus a lot on waistline because waistline is an indirect measure of insulin resistance. And I just want to tell you, if the woman's waistline is greater than 35 or the man's waistline is greater than 40 inches, that is an indirect measure of visceral adiposity. 35 inches for women, 40 inches for men. Write that down. It's going to show up probably on the exam. I'll add it to my slide set too. So when there's more visceral adiposity or abdominal fat, the more risk for insulin resistance. And insulin resistance can lead to vascular disease or heart disease. So heart disease is a leading cause of death for people with diabetes. They have 3 to 5 times the risk of different cardiovascular manifestations. Look at CHF, diabetes versus non-diabetes people, heart attack, heart disease, stroke. So when I ask people, what are you most worried about as far as complications of diabetes? Many times they don't mention heart disease. Heart disease is number one, numero uno, because when you have insulin resistance, what happens is this abnormal glucose stops your endothelial cells from working right. You get endothelial cell dysfunction. What does that mean? Well, you have less nitric oxide, so you don't vasodilate as well. You have more inflammation. You have more hypertension. You have more risk of thrombosis because all that sugar in your blood is sugarcoating everything and making it more likely to have clots. So we often term this atherosclerotic vascular disease and diabetes. And I love this slide. Let me tell you what this is. This is a nurses' health study. The nurses' health study is a prospective trial that's following nurses during their lifetime. And they're seeing what diseases they get and what behaviors, impacted or contributed to disease. So they looked at the relative risk of MI or stroke in these nurses who got type 2 diabetes. And if they were non-diabetic through the study, they had a very low risk of having a heart attack or stroke. But if they had diabetes and they looked back in time, 15 years or more before diagnosis, they had a doubling the risk of heart attack or stroke. 10 years before diagnosis, a tripling. You see, so even as they're not even diagnosed with diabetes, they have prediabetes, the rates of heart attack and stroke go up. So when I think about prediabetes, and people say don't worry about it, I am so worried about prediabetes because I know that patient is manifesting insulin resistance. They have higher risk heart attack and stroke, and now they just came out with a statement that they have higher risk of cancer. So prediabetes requires action. And here's all the different cardiometabolic risk factors. And what the American Diabetes Association says, if whatever risk factor you have, let's mitigate, let's treat it, let's minimize it. Because all of this associated with insulin resistance syndrome, the more of these risk factors you have, the higher your rate of heart disease and diabetes. So if your patients come in and they have hyperlipidemia and hyperglycemia, let's treat those and make sure we get them to target. So I'm a diabetes educator. I'm not going to treat those, but what I'm going to do is coach the patient to make sure they get the care from the provider that they need to get those to target. So we're going to coach, we're going to refer, we're going to, you know, really talk to our patients about the importance of getting these numbers to target. So when we think of diabetes, I just don't think of hyperglycemia. I think of these five hypers. They all go together. And you've seen this a million times on the HMP, patient admitted with heart attack, and a history of hyperlipidemia and hyperglycemia. Patient admitted with a stroke, history of hypertension and diabetes. Patient admitted with cellulitis, history of all three of those. You see what I'm saying? They come together. They're a cluster. We need to address their risk factors and mitigate them. And so here's the four hypers, and the fifth one I made up myself, hyperwaistlinemia. And here's the number, so I have that in a slide for you. These all are manifestations of insulin resistance. Cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of death for people with diabetes. We need to mitigate risk. In the last 5 minutes, we're just going to talk a little bit about the lower extremities. And here again, we're looking at non-modifiable risk factors and things that people can change. We want to focus on what we can change. And a lot of my patients who come into the clinic, you know, I teach diabetes classes to my patients, and at the very last day, I do a lower extremity assessment. So I want to look at their legs and their feet and touch them. I want to feel them and see what they look like, because then I can give them feedback on how to protect and take the best care possible of their feet. But as you look at this woman, I know you've seen these feet a million times. She has venous disease. The blood can get to her feet, but it has a hard time going back up to her heart. So it's hard to get her pulses because of edema, but her feet are warm. And the treatment for this is support hose, you know, elevate the feet, and avoid constriction. Make sure the shoes accommodate the feet. Peripheral arterial disease looks a lot different, and I'll show you a picture of that right here. The feet are kind of pale or reddish. There's no hair on their toes. It's hard to find pulses, not because of edema, but because they have poor circulation. And I'm always telling my patients, I'm looking for hair on your toes. And my patients are like, why are you looking for hair on my toes? And I'm like, well, grass don't grow where water don't flow. So if you don't have good circulation to your feet, the hair doesn't grow. So these limbs are high risk too for ulcerations and complications because there's not good blood flow to the bottom of the, to the extremities. And these feet are cool to touch. They're waxy a lot of time. And patients with PAD, peripheral arterial disease, have a very high risk of sudden death. And they might complain of intermittent claudication. When they walk, they get cramps. But keep walking, just take rests to help build up collateral circulation. So here's a profile of a high-risk foot, and their number one risk factor is previous amputation or previous ulceration. If a patient has already had an ulcer or an amputation, we know they're at very high risk for future amputation. And so we want to really help avoid those if at all possible. We definitely know that we can do provide basic instruction to prevent amputation. 50% of amputations can be avoided through self-care, education, and early intervention. And look up here at this first bullet point. We're doing a great job because rates of amputation have declined 65%. And when I say we, I mean diabetes educators because we're looking at feet. And this is a patient who came in to see me when I was working at Stanford back in, it was a while ago, 1995. And he really left a lasting impression on me that will last forever. And he came in with diabetes type 2, and he had been diagnosed with diabetes, I don't know, 8 months prior. And his doctor sent him home on glyburide, said, don't worry too much about your diabetes. You don't have the bad kind. Just take this medication. Don't worry about checking your blood sugars. Patient followed instruction, did as he was directed. But he did have this bad callus on the bottom of his foot. So, he went to his bathroom closet, took a razor blade and started trimming the bottom of his foot and to get rid of that callus. It was bothering him. But because he had diabetes and because he had peripheral neuropathy and poor circulation, this man has peripheral arterial disease. He's a smoker. That, when he took off that dead skin, he got to the healthy skin without knowing it, and it caused a huge cellulitis. This foot is on fire. They took him to the operating room hoping they would save his foot, but no, he had to have a partial foot amputation. Now, I know this amputation was completely avoidable. If he knew one fact, and here's the one fact, no bathroom surgery. And I impress this on my patients all the time. I have a lot of patients that I work with who are older, and they have very thick fungusy toenails, and they go to the garage, get the wire cutters to cut their toenails. And this is absolutely true. I've heard this story many, many times. And I say, well, did you cut your flesh? They're like, oh, yeah. So if you talk to patients and ask them the most important question, how do you cut your toenails? How do you take care of your feet? Who helps you? You're going to find out a lot of stuff they do right and a lot of stuff they do wrong. So you want to ask these questions, because just think of each one of us here saved 5 limbs during our lifetime. What a difference that would make. What if we each saved 20 limbs? Just by asking these questions and assessing. And they will have questions on the exam about high-risk feet and how to prevent foot problems. And I do want to talk for a minute about the monofilament. This monofilament is free from the government. So actually, it's not free because you're paying for it. So use it. And I put down here the website. It's from the Lower Extremity Amputation Prevention Program. You can get 10 free monofilaments. I order them and I get 50 for free. And at the end of each of my classes with my patients, I check the bottom of their feet. You have to make sure when you press this monofilament, you make it bend to a C shape, and that will deliver 10 grams of linear pressure. If the patient can't feel it in one or more sites, they have loss of protective sensation, which means their nerves have died. They're at higher risk for foot ulceration. So this patient I'm going to spend a lot of time on talking about preventive foot care. So get your monofilament today. The other thing I do want to tell you is that Medicare does pay for therapeutic shoes. So if the patient has loss of protective sensation, Medicare will cover one pair of shoes a year plus 2 inserts. So know that for the exam. Know that for real life. Here's 3 of the most important foot care tips. We could argue, and maybe there's another 1 or 2 we could throw in there. But inspecting the feet every day, getting some lotion on the top and bottom, because people with diabetes have drier feet. Don't go barefoot. Every time you see your doctor, take off your shoes and socks and show your feet and report any foot problems right away. I do have some information on periodontal disease and heart disease that you can look at for yourself. It's so important, I couldn't leave it out, but it probably won't be on the exam. But I do want to thank you very much. It is 101, okay, so I'm just 1 minute over. And we're going to be meeting again next week. I would encourage you to take tests. We talked about that at the beginning. Take as many tests as you can. Review the outline for the CDE exam. Read the articles I have listed on your resource page. Keep studying what you don't know. Exercise, that's important for our patients, and it's super important for us. And we will look forward to seeing you next week. I'm going to stop the recording right now, but I will stay online if you have any lingering questions, or please feel free to email me afterward. Thank you so much, everyone. It was a lot of fun spending this afternoon with you, and I hope you have a great rest of the day. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.